the agreement on the cessation of hostilities, according to Colonel Houston. So he thinks that it would have been impossible, Colonel Houston does, to hold a free election by secret ballot in North and South Vietnam on any subject back in 1956.
Last question.
Yeah, just with regard to... Oh, Stephen Morris. Just with regard...
I enjoyed your essay in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'd just like to ask a question. I haven't been into this particular subject as deeply as you have, but I have been familiar with the anti-war movement's arguments over the years. And the invocation of President Eisenhower, of course, as to the outcome of the elections is one of the most common ones. Do you know of any other statement made by President Eisenhower other than the one he made in his memoirs, Mandate for Change? Because in Mandate for Change, his statement was, I know of no person knowledgeable in Indochinese affairs who did not believe that if an election were held, as of the time of the fighting, between Ho Chi Minh and Bao Dai, that Ho Chi Minh would have won 80% of the vote. Now, that's the only statement I know of, and
yeah.
Of course, that's use of that statement is, of course, totally dishonest
yeah.
to talk about the outcome. But is there any other statement?
By Eisenhower on the elections,
on the elections.
As to who would have won in 1956, yeah. I've not come across any. You know it by heart. You've evidently had to answer it many times.
Right.
And what happens with Eisenhower's statement is that they... critics excise
right.
with the three ellipses, you know, they leave out at the time of the fighting and they leave out against Emperor Bao Dai. And so what you have Eisenhower saying in the critics' opinion is I've never talked with anyone knowledgeable in Indochinese affairs who did not believe that had elections been held, 80% of the people would have voted for Ho Chi Minh. But Eisenhower, as you correctly point out, is talking about 1954. And he's talking about an election between Ho Chi Minh, hypothetically, and Emperor Bao Dai. But the critics, they all do it. I mean, it's very difficult to find that full quotation. I do not know of any other statement that Ike made about the probability of Ho Chi Minh winning a 1956 election. If you ever come across one, I wish you'd send it to me, because I've been looking for it, too.
Thank you.
I might note...
Eisenhower followed that some minutes later by saying the kind of elections they have there under Ho Chi Minh, what other result could you expect? And that was never mentioned.
I might point out that there was an election or a plebiscite between Bao Dai and Ngo Dinh Diem. I believe it was, 98% for Diem. So that suggests that he might have been even more popular than Ho Chi Minh. I want to again thank Professor Loebs for a very enlightening presentation. Please. And if Doug Pike and Huang Guanqi will come forward, we will proceed immediately to the last panel of the day. Where is, there he is, yeah. Which way do you want? You'll go in first, okay. I believe we were going to put this blackboard up here for the... You want this up? I thought you said you were going to get somebody to lift it. Oh, there's room for it up here. Let's see. To put this
blackboard up here for the... You want this up?
Okay. I think we've done pretty well to come this close to the end of the day and only be starting 15 minutes late. It's important that we do that because, as I've said earlier in the day, that we do have some taping going on in a room upstairs, interviews for our television program, and Professor Pike has to do that, and so we're going to change the order here and have him speak first. He is one of the best-known scholars on Vietnam and has been for many, many years. He was an expert on Viet Cong and wrote extensively on this during the war when he was with the government, with the USIA from 1960 to 1969, a foreign service officer in Saigon. Again, he was stationed there from 73 to 75 as an Indochina Communist Affairs Advisor. He is currently the head of the Institute for East Asian Studies at the University of California in Berkeley. There are some good things out in Berkeley. Let's remember that. He is the author of several books, including War and Peace in the Viet Cong and Viet Cong Strategy of Terror, Professor Douglas Pike.
Thank you, Reed. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honor and a pleasure to be here. My assignment, as Reed indicated, is segment 106, America's Enemy. It's the section in the PBS series that deals with the other side in Vietnam. I have a large number of comments to make on this. I may not get through all of them. What I'd like to do is to begin with a few general observations about television as a medium for telling history, and then go to specific comments I have on this program talking about the other side in Vietnam. The psychological power of documentary television in general is so overwhelming that it seems incapable of understatement, just as the messages that it delivers with such visual and verbal impact that it rarely can avoid intellectual overkill. Television, when it's performing well, or you might even say especially when it's performing well, is a medium that's so strong that it emasculates its own best intentions. At the same time, television is the most limited of all our mass media. Its only truly effective domain is the finite rather than the abstract. It simply cannot handle abstractions. And within the finite, particularly the close-up, the talking head, or the very specific small shot, rather than the panoramic view, which is not the case in big theater documentaries, for example. Television seems always to be imprisoned in the flickering present, capable of only dealing with a moment in history, not its grand sweep, and confined by whatever is visually impressive, whether it's significant or not. Now, that was our general experience with television's coverage of the Vietnam War, and it seems to be our fate in post-war years in terms of retrospective documentary treatment. So we have under evaluation, then, a paradox in communication of ideas, something that is both awesomely powerful and hopelessly inane. It is no easy matter, I can tell you, to offer intelligible criticism to that. It's interesting, and we've done this as an exercise at Berkeley, this is a sort of a side, to evaluate and chart the reactions of various groups and segments to this series. The working journalists, if they did not serve in Vietnam, tended to approve it. Those who served there did not. Most television, commercial television critics approved of this series, with a few exceptions. Academics, surprisingly, have been almost entirely negative on it, although I'm not sure it's always for the right reason. Veterans groups have been exceedingly hostile. the ex-anti-war groups are divided. What I would call the sort of soft left is mixed feelings, damning it with faint praise. The hard left, the Hanoi or the Moscow cadre types, are exceedingly effusive. Strongest, most pro-favorable statements about this come from this crowd, and about the only group you find unqualified endorsement. French press, very critical, surprisingly. By far, of course, the most strongest and most consistent reaction have been the emigre Vietnamese, as you've heard here. Outrage, I think, would characterize the reaction by most 600,000 Vietnamese in this country. Old Vietnam hands, such as myself, tend to view it as cliche-ridden, but we've seen all this footage before. We've heard all the ideas expressed. For us, it was mostly a kind of collection of memories viewed through a very distorted lens. But I would argue that that's what Vietnam television history really is it's a collective memoir. It is not history, and it certainly was not made by historians. There simply isn't here evidence of a conscious intent to produce an historical account. All we get really is impressionism. Often it doesn't even rise to the level of the thematic. Now, history telling requires strict organization of priorities, mental discipline, not flitting from one subject to another, juxtaposition of events in out-of-time sequences, and in this case, the constant intercutting of airplanes. I would swear that in the 780 minutes of this thing, on an average, every 5 or 6 minutes, an airplane flies by, usually dropping bombs. Now, there's no visible effort here to adhere to any sort of historical methodology in choosing the visuals and to distinguish from what is titillating trivialities from that which is lasting historical judgment. Whatever this is, it is not history. Above all, what is lacking here is the most important single ingredient of history telling, and that is critical expert judgment, the benefits of the trained historian's knowledge. What is thrown at us in this series is unrefined raw opinion, self-serving rationalizations, and a great deal of mock heroic posturing from these talking heads. We get the principal military and civilian figures on both sides with their retrospective thinking. We get some angry survivors who lash out at villainy, perfidy, or bad luck. There's some there in the tube for only God knows why they were included. Just a parade of talking heads, largely, with airplanes flying by in between. Half the time, you don't even know who these people are. And even I, who have spent 20 years watching this, was uncertain both the first two times I went through the 106 as to who exactly these people were. I could figure out approximately who they were by what they were saying. But I can imagine that my children, who were watching in high school, of course, I mean, they watched briefly and then went upstairs to get a can of Sprite, obviously had no idea. I did a little interview with them afterwards. No idea of who was doing what to whom. Well, what we don't get, this is simply is not history. These talking heads are not history tellers. They're the actors of history. You don't tell them to tell your history for you and let it go at that. You ask them what happened as they remember it, and their answers are the raw material of history, the stuff with which you work. To treat them as anything more than this is simply to abrogate a historian's responsibility. Now, you might be interested in hearing the original promise of the producers of this series in the official proposal they sent to NEH in their bid for money. There are four of these, and they're described in great detail. Suffice here simply to list them so you can judge. The section that deals with this is called Statement of Purpose, and it says, and this is, quote, everything I say from here on is, quote, the telecast will advance four particular purposes of historical study. One, the programs will serve the record, that is, supply historical data. Two, the programs will offer an antidote to the misuse of history. That's a laugh. Three, the television series will assist in healing the damage to national self-esteem that the encounter with Vietnam produced. Does anyone think that any American, had his sense of national esteem lifted or his pride in America raised by watching this series, any American at all? Four, the program will make a contribution to historical method. It did that. How not to make a historical record. But, you know, when you read through this 200-page proposal and then watch this and then go back and read it again, what really comes over is a kind of palpable sense of hypocrisy and cynicism, almost, in selling this to the NEH. The reasons they give have absolutely nothing to do, really, with what you see subsequently. And as they say in Moscow, it is no accident, comrade. Well, let me turn to my central assignment, which is 106, America's Enemy. One left-wing critic discussing this said it was a segment that should have discussed politics in this very political war. And he added that the closest it came to it in any of the 13 was in this section, but it simply portrayed it as a kind of contest of wills between the two sides. I agree with that. There is nowhere in this whole 13 segment series of coming to grips with the meaning and the political purposes of the war. Now, throughout 106 and the rest of them, there are a variety of what you might call thematic notions or asides or one-line throwaways about the meaning of the war and its purpose. The most commonly encountered of these, I would say, is more of an implication than an assertion. But it is the notion or the idea that the war was without purpose, really, a sort of mindless exercise pursued by years, more or less by people on both sides. That's an impressionistic thing I have at the end of almost every segment. What they're saying is this whole thing was just sort of purposeless, mindless, absurd. I'm not sure whether this was the intention of the filmmakers or not, or deliberate or accidental, but it comes across very strongly, and it comes across strongly to other people I've talked about this. More emphatically, although usually in tacit fashion, what we are offered is perceptions of the meaning and the purpose of the war as it is held by Hanoi. That is, the purpose of the war was to unite North and South Vietnam under Hanoi's banner. Unification is shown as a moral imperative, as a holy crusade. Now, that's, of course, a legitimate perception from the North Vietnamese side. It is not, incidentally, even the perception of everyone on the other side, because the apparat in the South, the original National Liberation Front, did not share this entirely. And there were many differences between the two throughout the whole war, none of which is touched in the film. And the whole thing of any kind of difference between North and South insurgents is simply smothered. But the propriety and morality of unification is never questioned. It's not even examined. It's simply assumed. The competing perception never gets a fair presentation. In fact, it's never presented at all. That is, that the moral purpose of the war was to preserve the right of self-determination and establish the freedom of the South Vietnamese people. It's a perception that the war was a contest between open and closed societies, between freedom and tyranny, in which the U.S. had an obligation to contribute as part of its global interest in contributing to the cause of individual liberty everywhere. Agreed, South Vietnam was no democracy, but, it was argued, if it could remain non-communist and given peace, a fully representative government might emerge, whereas loss of personal freedom and liberty is certain and irreversible once a country goes communist. Now, that's the perception held by most South Vietnamese and, I believe, at least in the early years, by most Americans. But one would never know it by watching this historical source. Similarly, American motives are consistently impugned. The Americans went to Vietnam, it is implied, to enjoy the war. American behavior there is pictured as a mindless brutality, perhaps unintentional, but nevertheless brutal. The fact is that the 3 million Americans who went to through Vietnam during the war, to the extent that they thought much about it at all, I think, went there for the general notion to try to put things right. Now, what that means, to put things right, can be variously interpreted, and was, by various people who went to Vietnam. We are a diverse society, a multipolar society. But nevertheless, I think generally the motive was there, along with the spirit and the impulse to sacrifice. In this, they may have been naive, possibly they even have been wrong, but the intended goodwill deserves some acknowledgement. Their willingness to sacrifice deserves recognition. Instead, they are pictured as simply intruding butchers, while the communists are portrayed as figures in a morality play. Another major competing perception of the ultimate responsibility of the war. Who is to blame? Again, the characterization over and over, to the extent that there was a devil in the thesis, the devil thesis of history was being employed, is entirely placed in Washington, and to a lesser degree in Hanoi and Saigon among the South Vietnamese. I don't personally believe in the devil thesis of history. I think it's a mark of an amateur historian. Vietnam, I think, particularly had a kind of inexorable quality about it that trapped everyone there, and nobody was really in control. Not in Hanoi, not in Saigon, not in Washington. They were all being carried along by this. But the simplistic treatment in this series is to put all the blame on Lyndon Johnson and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and later on Nixon and Kissinger. Well, now let me turn to some of the images of the enemy found in 106 and what do they add up to? Well, they add up to this. The communists are portrayed as basically honorable, uncorrupted, idealistic people fighting a just cause. They were also portrayed as nationalists. In fact, if one is to believe this film, they were the only nationalists on the site. In dealing with outsiders, as in negotiations with the U.S., the communists are portrayed as forthright and scrupulously adhering to any agreement reached. They were perhaps authoritarian, the film suggests, but enlightened, and seldom bloody-handed. Further, they embrace the principle of independence, fighting on their own battles, self-contained, dependent on no outsiders. In short, they monopolize such virtue as did exist in the Vietnam War. This was made particularly apparent in comparing them with the South Vietnamese. A more accurate historical picture is the judgment that the North Vietnamese, in terms of personality and behavior, were no different from the South Vietnamese. And if they appeared more attractive, this was simply ignorance on the part of the viewer. If their performance was more determined, it was because they were better organized, not because they were more virtuous. Corruption existed in the North. It was a different kind, and it was better concealed, but it still was there. In dealing with the U.S., the regime often lied and dissembled. In fact, the history of the Vietnam War from the communist side is an unrelieved record of duplicity and deceit. Vietnamese communists used terror judiciously and selectively, but such rational treatment of terror makes it more rather than less of an atrocity. Hanoi claimed independence and self-sufficiency, but this, of course, was an absurdity. There are no arms factories in North Vietnam. Everything that was used in terms of military hardware had to be brought in. Finally, this point on the South Vietnamese, who are the real victims, I think, in this film. With South Vietnam and the treatment of South Vietnam, this film distortion reaches its zenith. In the treatment of the South Vietnamese society has found the grossest inaccuracies. Here is displayed contempt for the individual South Vietnamese that is even racist in its quality. The filmmakers display an ugly mixture of arrogance, prejudice, and ignorance. Through all 13 segments of this film, the South Vietnamese government is vilified, South Vietnamese army is slandered, and by extension, the entire South Vietnamese population, except the Viet Cong, are libeled. You listen in vain for one empathetic word about the South Vietnamese anywhere through here, or one picture that's sort of understanding. You don't find a single one. South Vietnam is simply dismissed as not even worth considering. In discussing the Paris talks that led to the 73 ceasefire, we are told by the narrator, the U.S. brought in the GVN, and the North Vietnamese brought in the Viet Cong. Brought in is the term used, that there was no involvement really on their part. The title of 106, America's Enemy. Not the South Vietnamese enemy, America's enemy. It was as though the South Vietnamese were sort of a non-people. We're shown the South Vietnamese exclusively as a fragmented society, unviable from the start, as government corrupt, repressive, unrepresentative. They did not deserve to succeed, its army incompetent and unmotivated. The fact is that South Vietnamese society during those years was no more divisive than many other Asian societies, such as Malaysia, for example. It was simply subjected to greater strain. As governments go in Asia, the South Vietnamese government was more or less middling in terms of representational repressiveness qualities. It was better than some and worse than others. Under the circumstances of an armed enemy everywhere, it could hardly avoid authoritarianism. But in fact, it was much less totalitarian than most outsiders believe. The South Vietnamese were widely and in many cases deeply anti-communist. Few wanted an outright communist victory, which is why the entire North Vietnamese army remains on garrison duty in the South, and why a million people have fled. And the greatest example of people voting with their feet in recent history. What the South Vietnamese are presented in this film and are relied on, really, to carry the burden of the South's history are totally unrepresentative. We get only the worst examples of the Southern Vietnamese people. Ngo Dinh Luyen, for example, a major figure here, Zim's idiot nephew, who was, his clownish behavior was simply a carry-on of what he's always been doing. I mean, the stories in the press corps and the U.S. mission about this guy in the 60s are legendary. And yet he is held up as sort of the major spokesman, along with a couple of inarticulate South Vietnamese generals, and what else, an Arvin soldier looting the dead. You cannot believe that that kind of treatment is accidental or unintended. Well, I have a good deal more to say here about this. On the parochialism of the war, the weapons imbalance, Vietnamese nationalism, Ho Chi Minh. I think most of these comments have been covered earlier in the day. However, perhaps some of them we can touch on when we come to questions or comments. Thank you very much.
Since Doug has got to go up, I think we may take a question or two to him now, and then he can go to do his interview. Doug, I'd like to start with one question. One thing that you are an expert on, we're an expert on, is the Viet Cong, and I think especially the atrocities and the Hue massacre. Would you care to say a word about that and how it was portrayed in the film?
Yes, well, I've got some notes on this, which I can probably save me some time. Yeah, it's a myth. Generally, it's this myth of sort of the imbalance in terms of inhumanity, inhumaneness by the Americans and by the Vietnamese on the two sides. And the reference to Viet Cong terrorism in this in 106 particularly is always very blandly expressed and sort of antiseptically presented. In kind of an Olympian objectivity. VC terror is very quickly told, and there's no dwelling on the matter. A village leader, we are told, is executed by the VC because they, quote, wanted to frighten the Vietnamese out of government workers out of the village. The implication is that these victims somehow brought the deaths upon themselves because they went into the villages to build roads or spray for mosquitoes for malaria control. Deadly road mines that kill indiscriminately are glossed over with a quick reference. When we look at the wrecked vehicles in what appears to be an automobile junkyard, the remains of school buses and ambulances. But the GVN humanity, mistreating prisoners, for example, is lingered over and sort of dwelled on and treated with a kind of maximum gore and grisliness. In And the Way massacre is just, of course, swept under the rug entirely. The Dachshund, which I think is the worst atrocity of the war, when VC went through a Montagnard village with flamethrowers, burning anything that moved, and just shooting them into houses. I was at Dachshund the following day. When you drive up in the village, it looks like there's charred cordwood piled along the road, and you get close and you realize they're bodies of babies, small children. Dachshund was widely reported, but it's simply been lost in the morass of history. Nobody picks up Dachshund. Nobody does anything with it. If this were at all a fair film, that would have at least equaled, had a segment on that that would deal with what happened there and countless other. I've got a book that thick of list of names of Vietnamese village officials who were assassinated up to about 1965. It amounted to virtually genocide, I mean, by the dictionary definition, going through and excising out a whole segment of the population, the natural leaders in villages. By 65, in most of the South Vietnam villages, they were all gone. They'd all been killed. Yes.
We've just had two... Oh, Bob Dreher, former Vietnam employee. We just had two professors in a row, one of us telling us what a terrible history the film is, from even just from a professional, technical point of view, and the predecessor telling us how widely it's being used in academia for history. How do we reconcile this contradiction, the number of knuckleheads running our history departments?
I don't disagree with what Bruce said, but I mean, there are ideologues and ex-cadre types that are in the woodwork in some universities. They're not in Berkeley. They never got tenure. I see this as a problem. But I see as a much greater problem in the university are the non-ideologues, the kind of honest young international relations graduates who go out to Midwest colleges and teach a course in... asked to teach a course in the history of the Vietnam War, really don't know much about it. They're not ideologically committed. That was the Fox Butterfield article about in the Times a year ago. That was the thing that struck him most. He expected to find ideologues, and what he found was people who were using Francis Fitzgerald as the text and saying, why are you using it? And he said, well, I went to the library, and there were 12 copies of it there, so it must be an important book. I mean, the point is they pass on the conventional fictions and the conventional wisdom, but they don't do it for ideological reasons, but of course that's, you know, if you pass on ignorance, it doesn't really make too much difference why you're doing it. It's quite true, you are raising a generation of children who do not understand the Vietnam War, and I despair that they ever will from the way things are going.
Thank you.
My name's Al Santoli, I'm a journalist, and I back up what you said about the landmines. When I used to be a soldier way back when, and I used to have to patrol 6 a.m., 7 a.m., Highway 13, Highway 1, where people would bring in their produce from the rice fields in the small farming villages in Cu Chi and Hau Nia and the areas close to Cambodia. The VC would plant mines at night knowing they were not going to hit American convoys. The first people out in the mornings that ran those roads were the farmers, and they were the ones that took the heavy casualties, the women, the kids. I mean, it's basically the old women, the grandmothers, the kids, the old men were the ones that brought their stuff. It's basically the women that manipulated that market. And I thought that was horrendous. And one of the things, the real tough things, in coming back to the U.S. and being called a baby killer and everything when I went to university, and had people at that time, 69, 70, 71, coming back from China and extolling the barefoot doctors and not talking about the previous land reform movement, which was the predecessor of both the North Vietnamese land reform and then the Khmer Rouge land reform done by Mao's. And also, Mr. Chi will talk about this, I'm sure, about the Maoist cadre, the Chinese cadre that oversaw the North Vietnamese land reform battalions as they oversaw the Khmer Rouge out in the field. But basically, there's this premise that they'll always say, well, in 1960 in a little farm in Benoit, you know, Win Hu To and Trinh Dinh Thao and Trung Nhu Thong were these great, you know, lawyers and doctors and pharmacists who were so upset with Diem that they decided they would have the spontaneous movement of peasants and students and intellectuals. Now, you know more about the documentation than I do. When actually did Hanoi talk about the revolt in the South? When was the Ho Chi Minh Trail formed and supplies start moving south? And what kind of role did Hanoi have as far as instigating manipulation and organizing in South Vietnam before this, quote, spontaneous plantation meeting in 1960, November of 1960, I think they talk about?
Yeah, well, for a long time, you know, we were beleaguered to try to establish May 59 as the day, as the month when the fifth plenum agreed to become armed struggle in the South. Widely denounced on this, French intellectuals writing on it have been savaging that for a long time. Now, of course, at the end of the war, a great outpouring of materials from Hanoi. We get General Tra. We get a magnificent thing called Military Events, which is a kind of chronological history that not only documents this in great detail, when we started building the Ho Chi Minh Trail, it pushes the whole thing back to 1958 to 1957, back past when the point when I think they're overdoing it. I mean, but they talk of full-scale VC battalions being organized on paper in as early as January 1957, which I don't think was true. I mean, on paper, maybe they were. They
you
did
know,
exist.
There's one thing, excuse me for interrupting, but there are people I've talked to that were in the early Viet Cong, the people that had gone up in 54 then came back in 55, that said to me things about which I don't understand about 57, about the first order came down in 57 to now begin the struggle.
Now, well, that's what it now says. We never got anything on this before, but the point is actually the North Vietnamese, or Hanoi historians now, are just shunting the NLF aside from beginning to end, really. They fuzz over that it was the NLF in the South at the beginning, just our forces loyal to us. At the end, from about 68 on, they just brush the PLAF aside. And the whole war was their victory. They don't give even grudging credit to the Viet Cong in the South. That's true in Jop's book, and more true, I think, in General Zung's book.
Zung also, yeah.
Okay, last question.
My name is Lou Morano. I'm an anthropologist and Renaissance man. And I also remember what communist landmines did to Vietnamese up in the Northern I Corps. But I have a mischievous question for you as an academic who has recently taught a course on Vietnam at a Midwestern university, trying to give a little bit more balance to things. And that is, I wonder what the reaction in the Western intellectual community would be if some very strong and charismatic West German leader decided that the reunification of his country was very important in order to bring the benefits of Christianity and free enterprise to the whole thing. You know, we keep on hearing time and time again about how Ho Chi Minh and his followers were justified because, after all, they were only reunifying their country. But, I mean, the speciousness of this argument is...
That's how far things have gone. I mean, at one time, this was not really considered unification as an intellectually defensive argument by anybody, really. I mean,
when did that change?
Well, it's been a gradual thing. I mean, before, what it meant was unification meant the North Vietnamese would take over South Vietnam, take over somebody else's country, different society, different government, different educational system, two separate entities. They both speak Vietnamese, but you're two distinct entities, and that's what the war was seen. Now it's we fall into the trap of saying the war was all about was unification. It's a nice antiseptic word. What it really means is conquering another country. But it's as I say, it's an indication how far the rot really has gone in interpreting this war.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Okay, my congratulations to you. We have, I think, more people here at 5 o'clock than we had this morning when we started at 9:15. I think that's a tribute to you and a tribute to our speakers. Our last speaker for the day before the banquet tonight is a very distinguished Vietnamese and author, Huan Van Chi. He was born in 1913 in northern Vietnam. He graduated from the Lycée Albert Sarrau in Hanoi and joined the French Socialist Party in 1936. In 1945, joined the Viet Minh Resistance and served the Ho Chi Minh government in many capacities, including director of the National Mint and as a chemist for the Ministry of Defense. When the regime turned toward a full communist dictatorship, he fled to Saigon in 1955. His family suffered heavily during the land reform terror. Two of his uncles were tortured and died in prison, and a cousin and his wife were driven to commit suicide. He left the country in 59 to take a year's appointment as vice consul in Delhi and settled in Paris in 1960 and came here in 1964. His book, From Colonialism to Communism, is a tremendous account, and one that's very famous, of course. He's very famous for his description of the horrors of the land reform program that Ho Chi Minh implemented in North Vietnam. It's my very great pleasure to give you Huan Van Chi.
What is wrong with the PBS film has been discussed by the preceding speakers. I want to go beyond that and to discuss the problem. And that is, why these people have such a liking for the communist regime in Vietnam. Is it naivety? Is it because they have some kind of advantage? But I simply want to mention one fact. That is, if they were objective and impartial, or try to be so, there's still many difficulties for an American to see the truth in a communist regime like Vietnam. And I think that is important because now the Americans are facing with the problem in Central America. If there's still Americans who believe that by staying here, they can understand everything in Nicaragua or El Salvador, we may have another PBS film or another team like that on future problems. First, I think it's difficult to be objective for anyone, for everyone. We used to see things through our own lens. And impartiality is human nature. For instance, if we are born into a religion, any religion, we tend to believe that our religion is better than the only other one. Or, if you ask a Democrat, either a Democrat or a Republican, on how we think about President Reagan's achievement, if you ask a Democrat, like Mr. Gary Hart, he will say that Mr. Reagan doesn't deserve, is so bad that he doesn't deserve to be president of the U.S. But if you ask a Republican, he will give you an opposite opinion. So that is a difficulty, to be objective and impartial in looking at something from another country, in another country, give a correct interpretation.